Good Sunday to you, and welcome to Cutting the Curd on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Ann Saxelby. Today's episode of Cutting the Curd is being produced by Jack Inslee and engineered by Nat Wiener. And we'd like to give a big thanks to our sponsor for today, Hearst Ranch. So, joining me on today's show is David Gumpert, author of the recently published book, The Raw Milk Revolution, Behind America's Emerging Battle Over Food Rights, which was put out there by Chelsea Green. Well, we're going to be discussing the controversy surrounding one of our most fundamental foodstuffs, raw milk. What was once consumed daily by countless people across the globe has now become a substance regulated in some cases almost as strictly as narcotics by some states and agencies in the United States. And being a cheesemonger, I come up against the raw milk debate quite often. In the U.S., it is illegal to sell cheese made from raw milk that is aged for less than 60 days, meaning that a lot of soft cheeses, fresh dairy products, butter, yogurt, milk, I can't sell at my store, and I would very much like to. And so I, you know, personally would love to see a lot of these regulations relaxed so that people could enjoy raw milk and the beautiful products that, you know, can be made from raw milk. And I'm hoping that our conversation with David today can help to shed some light on the different elements of this battle and tell us a little bit about what the state of raw milk in the United States is. So without further ado, let's get Mr. Gumpert on the line to see just what's going on in the world of raw milk. Welcome to Cutting the Curd, David.
Thank you, Ann. Glad to be here.
How are you doing today?
Good, good. It's I'm up in New Hampshire, and it's a crisp, cold, snowy day.
Oh, excellent, excellent. Well, down here in New York, it's definitely crisp and cold, too. We didn't get too much snow, but hopefully in the next couple weeks. Everyone thinks I'm weird because I want it to snow, but I'm from Chicago originally, so, you know.
Well, so am I. I understand where you're coming from.
Well, thank you so much for taking some time out to be on the show today. So I wanted to ask you kind of how you came to write this book. It seems like you've worn many different journalistic hats. What led you to write a book about raw milk?
Two things led me to write it. One is that I've spent much of my journalistic writing career reporting and on small business and entrepreneurship.
Mm-hmm.
And I also, so that's kind of one part of it. And I've written a number of books about how to start a small business and how to do a business plan.
And what could be more entrepreneurial than being a small farmer in today's economy?
Exactly. Well, you took the words right out of my mouth. I became interested several years ago in alternative health and different approaches to alternative health. And the one of the things I began reporting on was how the U.S. Food and Drug Administration was making life difficult for small companies and the alternative health arena. And that kind of led into the raw milk thing.
Interesting, because I know at before you wrote this book, you have a blog, isn't that right?
Yes, I have a blog called The Complete Patient. So it's just the way it sounds. It's www.thecompletepatient.com.
Mm-hmm.
And I began reporting there in early 2006 about some of the issues around alternative health and regulatory issues around these smaller organizations, that smaller companies that were being hassled by the FDA, and I think it was really September and October of 2006. There were all of a sudden a number of events that occurred right around the same time. With regard to raw milk, there was a situation in California where the California Department of Food and Agriculture shut down a raw dairy, the largest raw dairy in California, because several children became ill and they thought it was from the raw milk, and they shut that dairy down for 10 days. In Michigan, authorities carried out a sting operation against a raw dairy producer, just as he was delivering milk to co-op members in Ann Arbor.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were a number of incidents going on in Ohio, including one where agents from the FDA and the Ohio Department of Agriculture intercepted a farmer delivering raw milk, or actually dropping it off to members of a cooperative type arrangement in Cincinnati, and they kind of cornered this guy and questioned him so intensively he collapsed and developed post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms and couldn't work for 6 months.
I read that in your book. I was astounded to hear that. I mean, but that just gives, I guess, that, you know, gives people out there an idea of what sort of crazy measures the government will go to for something like raw milk. I buy some raw milk cheese from a farmer in New Jersey, and he was joking around one day saying, you know, that milk is, you know, second in sort of regulatory attention from you know, their state government, only to narcotics. And I was like amazed, you know, something that used to, that should not be subject to that kind of scrutiny, in my opinion anyways. They just take such drastic measures.
Well, yeah, it's interesting. I think what's important to keep in mind that the reason these incidents happened, it wasn't just a happenstance. The government was becoming increasingly concerned that raw milk was growing in popularity. And they had been, the FDA and the Centers for Disease Control had been warning people for years about raw milk. And what's been happening is that increasingly people are ignoring those warnings. So every time they warn people, it seems like sales go up. And so what they decided to do was, instead of trying to influence the consumer, they would try to interfere with the production.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was really what was, or what, not only what was behind the 2006 events, but continues to be behind ongoing events. I mean, right now we're seeing a big crackdown in Wisconsin.
Interesting.
And they move around from dairy producing state to dairy producing state.
And so, well, that's an interesting thing too, because I feel like for a lot of people who are interested in raw milk, it's a subject that is kind of shrouded in mystery, and you know, how to get it, what is it, you know, and I think something that contributes to that is the fact that raw milk is regulated state by state, as opposed to having a sort of nationwide FDA policy.
Well, that is. Pretty much true, although it's important to keep in mind that the FDA in the late 1980s instituted a ban on interstate shipment of raw milk. One of the reasons that the FDA got involved in the incidents I mentioned in Ohio and Michigan is because some of the milk, some of the dairy products had traveled between states, and so they do get involved to that extent. But you're right, for the most part, each state has its own regulation or its own law about raw milk, and it's pretty crazy. There are about 21 states that completely prohibit the sale of raw milk. In many of those states, though, consumers have established what are known as herd share arrangements, and what they do basically is they buy a share in the cows of a dairy,
so
and
it's
then
essentially,
they're entitled to some of the milk as it's produced.
So it's essentially like a co-op, like someone joins a co-op, and then they're expected to participate in some way in the day-to-day workings of the store, except for in this case we're talking about an actual farm instead of a store.
Yes.
Okay.
Some other states, I think there are about a half a dozen states where raw milk can be sold, but only as pet food. So you have that in Florida and Georgia and a few other states. And then there are about a half a dozen states where raw milk is actually legal to be sold retail. And that's the case in Connecticut. A lot of New Yorkers buy their raw milk in Connecticut, and it's a case in Maine. The biggest state that allows the retail sale of raw milk is California,
right.
And there are an estimated somewhere between 50 and 65,000 consumers out there who just, you know, can regularly buy their milk at Whole Foods and various health stores.
That seems like such a luxury. Oh my goodness.
It is. It is. And people there sometimes comment on my blog about they realize how lucky they are to be able to do that. I guess when they read about some of the things going on in places like Wisconsin and Ohio.
Because, yeah, for somebody, once you've tasted raw milk, to drink anything else seems like, you know, not as good. It's like if you're going to go for it, you might as well go whole hog. And the taste of raw milk is just so sort of wonderful and rich.
It is. And the other thing that goes on is that people experience health benefits. This is an area that's kind of shrouded in scientific mystery because there aren't a lot of studies to support it, but you have a lot of people who say that things like lactose intolerance goes away, that their the children's asthma improves, mm-hmm. The allergies go away. So that you have those kinds of testimonials, what the scientists refer to as anecdotal evidence. But for those families who experience those benefits, it almost becomes, as you said earlier, like a drug, in the sense that they become very dependent on this food.
Now, I mean, can we just go back for a minute and talk, because I'm very interested in the science and all this, the scientific part of it and the benefits of drinking raw milk. But before we get into that, I think it would be interesting to discuss a little bit about why raw milk became sort of stigmatized in the first place and how, you know, what started off as sort of a perfect food designed by Mother Nature, you know, has, you know, how pasteurization became the norm in the first place. Could we talk about that for a minute?
Sure, sure. Well, you know, until about 1900, all milk was raw milk. When you think about it historically, for hundreds of years before then, all milk was consumed unpasteurized, and there really wasn't much of a problem that we know about mm-hmm. until the mid-1800s, which is the time of the Industrial Revolution.
Of course.
And what you had was many people moving from the farm to the city.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they moved to the city, people moved to the city, and they needed their milk. And what happened in many cases is the cows moved to the city as well, and you actually had a situation
not quite the same as being out on pasture. Let's say
no, it was really not even close. You had situations. In fact, I describe it in my book where you had the equivalent of really the first feedlots, as it were, in places like Brooklyn.
Right.
You had
which were oftentimes linked to distilleries, right, or breweries.
And what the animal raisers, I guess the city farmers, as it were, and the distilleries had in common that the mutual interest was that the grains could be, after they were used to make alcohol, could then be fed to the cows,
which of course is an erroneous thought, because cows are, you know, they are ruminants and they're designed to digest grass, not
right.
spent
and,
grain.
And not only are they designed to digest grass, but they are fed grains. Even today, in our feedlots, cattle are fed corn and other grains, but it's not a natural food for them, but the grain they were receiving from these distilleries was totally it was pretty much devoid of nutrients, so because it had been used to make the alcohol. And so what you had was cows receiving this really unnatural, depleted food, and so they became sick, and they produced watery milk,
which in turn made other people sick.
Well, it certainly made the cows susceptible to illness, and then you had there really wasn't much understanding during those days of the importance of refrigeration, and so the importance of sanitation. So you had workers who often were had diseases themselves. They might have tuberculosis, or they might have been exposed to tuberculosis, and they would pass that on in the milk. and typhoid, and at the same time, we really didn't understand much about these diseases. We didn't understand much about the dangers of pathogens. So you had all these things kind of coming together, and
pasteurization at that point then would seem like a pretty excellent solution, a sort of cure-all.
Yes. You had many children. Thousands of children would die in outbreaks in the late 1800s and early 1900s. And once pasteurization was applied, those death rates went way down.
Interesting.
Yeah. I mean, you had other things going on, too, which tend to get overlooked in the propaganda war when the CDC and the FDA talk about it. I mean, you had sewage systems being built in the late 1800s, early 1900s, so the water began to be cleaned up, and that was certainly a factor in a lot of the illnesses that were breaking out.
Absolutely. Well, actually, I hate to interrupt us right here, but we do have to take a short break, and when we come back, I definitely want to talk about that and how that ties in, because I feel like looking at raw milk as and our health as a holistic thing, as opposed to isolating this, you know, one culprit, is a very important part of your book. So we'll be back in a minute on Cutting the Curd. Welcome back to Cutting the Curd on the Heritage Radio Network. Our show today has been sponsored by Hearst Ranch. And my guest today is David Gumpert, author of the book The Raw Milk Revolution, Behind America's Emerging Battle Over Food Rights, which is published by Chelsea Green. So, David, we were just talking about other factors that sort of led to sickness in this time. And I think that that would be kind of a perfect time to talk about the different scientific theories of the age, which in your book, you kind of posit Louis Pasteur at one end of the spectrum, and then Bechamp and some other scientists at the other end of the spectrum, and how their theories kind of play into those ideas, you know, being sort of Louis Pasteur isolating one element that's a problem versus Bechamp and the others talking about the body as a whole organism, and how different systems kind of can interact with each other and cause, you know, health or disease.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Louis Pasteur came up with something called the germ theory. And that is the idea behind the germ theory, which really is still the prevalent theory that our medical community operates under, is that germs cause disease. And our challenge, the scientific challenge, the medical challenge, is to get rid of those germs. So, and we saw dramatic examples of that with antibiotics. We're still kind of obsessed with that battle, with all the advice today to use sanitizers and to in France to avoid hugging and, you know, all this kind of thing.
In France, the country where people kiss each other, like on the cheek, that's
exactly,
like as an initial reaction. That's very strange.
It is very strange, but it's part of a kind of a climate of fear that has developed over germs and bacteria. When in fact, there are pathogens that can lead to illness, but there are also friendly bacteria that are very important, and that kind of starts to get into the whole raw milk thing.
Because, so can you tell us a little bit about the opposing science, the Bechamps and the Metchnikoffs and some of the other people that were proposing a different theory around the same time, but that ended up getting sort of overlooked?
Yeah, there were a number of scientists. I mean, all these scientists were French, and you had Louis Pasteur, who was promoting the germ theory. Then you had a number of scientists who were opposed that, and it was really a subject of pretty intense debate during the 1880 to 1900 period, when a lot of advances were being made, and just in terms of understanding the fact that pathogens existed and that people could get ill as a result of pathogens. But you had a French physiologist by the name of Claude Bernard, and he talked about something, and you'll pardon my French, called the milieu intérieur, which he was convinced that it was this what he called the internal environment of the individual that determined their inclination to stay healthy or to get sick, and that and as you said, Eli Metchnikoff, who talked about notion that white blood cells attack germs that get into our systems and fight those germs. And those more holistic type approaches were opposed by Pasteur and by his supporters. And so I guess Pasteur had something, I was going to say he had something of the promotional talent, but he also had something else going for him, and that is that it's just a lot easier for people to relate to the idea that that we have these bad germs and we got to kill them, and it's straightforward and simple.
Yeah, absolutely. I was thinking about a lot of science is reductionist, and it was kind of the same. I feel like there are some tie-ins even to our current system of agriculture. Where they isolated certain elements in the soil and they said these elements are necessary for plants to grow vigorously, and so they put more of those elements into the soil without thinking about the repercussions of, kind of the soil as a whole and how those things, all those things interact.
Right. You kind of lose sight of the fact, for instance, that there are, and this is both in the soil and in people, that there are certain trace elements, trace minerals that are very important.
And so raw milk, in fact, you argue in your book, has a lot of those sort of beneficial, enzymes and bacteria and other things like that that help our system combat illness and build immunity and stuff like that.
Yeah. Now, once, as I said earlier, the research is limited, but the research that is there is suggesting that raw milk does have certain properties. As you point out, the things like beneficial bacteria, various microorganisms and enzymes. There was a big study out of Europe just within the last 3 years that showed that children who consumed raw milk had lower incidences of asthma and allergies, for example. So there is data beginning to be to come together on this.
And who are the people organizing this data? Because it seems like our government's fighting as hard as they can to, sort of say everything to the contrary. But it seems very important that there are people out there doing this research. So how's that happening?
Well, there's a group of scientists that got together in Europe, and it actually included some American researchers, but it was under European auspices. And you're correct, the Europeans are more open to the idea that raw milk has benefits, and in this country it would be very difficult to get that kind of study going because the medical establishment and the federal government are just so steadfast in their opposition to raw milk that if the FDA really, the head of the dairy division of the FDA won't even allow himself to be in the same building with people who are in favor of raw milk.
Wow.
It's really that visceral.
Well, that seems like that's a pretty powerful statement. And so that, I thought that was very interesting in your book that you said that even though the incidences of illness, which you described, there was an incidence in California and a few others, these things were blamed on raw milk by the government, but then when there was suspicion raised that actually raw milk was not the cause of different, different sicknesses in the country, the government would not even comment on those, on those findings, which I found very interesting. This kind of radio silence.
Yeah, I mean, it's they don't want to talk about those situations. Although I think it's important to keep in mind, and that people can get ill from raw milk, but they can also get sick from pasteurized milk, and they can get sick from spinach, and they can get sick from peanut butter. So it is important to appreciate that it's possible to get sick from food, and there are many thousands of illnesses every year from foodborne illness. We actually have some pretty significant legislation in Congress right now to deal with the whole issue of foodborne illness. But I don't want to suggest that that all the reports of illness from raw milk are
faulty
misstated.
Or anything. Yeah, absolutely.
But there have been a number of situations. The case I mentioned in Michigan, where they did a sting operation, that turned out to be a case where, based on a family becoming sick, and it turned out that the family, initially the illnesses were blamed on raw milk, but more likely the illnesses were the result of some bad pasteurized milk.
Very interesting. So we only have a couple of minutes left, and for those couple of minutes, I wanted to talk to you about the idea that you mentioned on the back of your book. There's a big sort of headline in red that says, "The Right to Healthy Food, the New Civil Rights Movement." And I think that's a very interesting way to think about it. Sort of the right to choose our food has been sort of a fundamental, inalienable right up until recently. And can you just sort of explain to us sort of other examples of people not being able to choose, the foods that they enjoy? I think you mentioned, I don't know, almonds and some other things like
right.
that.
Right. I mean, one of the things that's very interesting about the way this all happens, and this is the case with milk, is the government doesn't try to change these things overnight. Pasteurization came into play gradually, beginning in the early 1900s, and it wasn't really until the end of the century that all of a sudden people looked around and found that it was very difficult to find raw milk because it had been pretty much eliminated via pasteurization.
Sure.
But the same kind of thing has happened with things like apple cider. If you remember, it was a time not too long ago where you could buy unpasteurized apple cider in the store or at farm stands.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost impossible to find unpasteurized apple cider today. Vegetable juices, fresh vegetable juices, were pretty widely available. It's you can't go into a grocery store today and buy unpasteurized vegetable juice. You can't, as you mentioned, almonds. You can't. It's very difficult to find unpasteurized beer. And the same kinds of what they call scientific or standards, pasteurization as being a scientifically endorsed standard, are being applied to other things. The most notable is irradiation. And now the FDA said earlier this year that irradiation is safe. And so we're going to start, actually vegetables are and meats are starting to be irradiated.
Wow. So are those the kinds of things that people can learn more about on your blog, The Complete Patient?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, they can learn more about it in my blog and in the book, The Raw Milk Revolution.
It's an incredible resource because I feel like it's a sort of generational thing. People that I grew up with wouldn't even know to ask for raw milk because I never grew up drinking it. And, it wasn't until I met a dairy farmer who sold raw milk cheese that thought even occurred to me. So I feel like the re-education of people about natural foods and what their options are is kind of right now probably one of our biggest battles.
Yes, I agree.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time out to be on the show. And I would encourage everybody to look at your blog, The Complete Patient, and also to pick up a copy of The Raw Milk Revolution, published by Chelsea Green, because it is an incredible chronicle of one of our most potent foodstuffs that should be able to be enjoyed in its unadulterated state. So thanks for being on the show, and I will talk to you very soon.
Okay, thank you, Anne.
Thanks, David.